Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Piper Aircraft against Reno and the related case. Simons, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Chief Justice Berger, and may it please the Court, the order which permits us to come before this Court today restricts the appeal to the sole question of whether a federal court action brought by a non-resident foreign plaintiff against an American defendant, whether in that type of action the plaintiff may defeat a motion to dismiss brought on the ground of forum nonconvenience merely by showing that the substantive law that would be applied if the case were litigated in that plaintiff's home court would be different or less favorable than it would be if it were tried here in America. The factual background of this case is quite significant. In 1976, there was a small six-seat aircraft that crashed into the mountains of Scotland. It was on a charter flight from England to Scotland, and the crash resulted in the deaths of all six people on board, five passengers and the pilot. All of these people were Scottish citizens. The aircraft had been owned, operated, and maintained for several years prior to the accident by Scottish interests, and the pilot was employed by a Scottish company. The aircraft was registered with the British authorities, and the pilot was licensed by the Scottish authorities. And the accident was investigated by the British Department of Trade. The department's proposed report was the subject of an evidentiary hearing, which was conducted by a review board headed by Mr. and later Lord Jauncey, who was assisted again by two technical advisors from Scotland. Substantial documentary evidence went before this hearing, and some 13 witnesses testified, most of whom were technicians from Great Britain. The hearing took place in Edinburgh, Scotland, and as I say, it lasted for 9 days. In addition, Lord Jauncey spent a day in Farnborough, England, inspecting the wreckage of the aircraft. Presently, what remains of the wreckage is still at Farnborough. As a result of the accident, a California resident, Gainal Reno, has brought this action to recover for the heirs and next of kin of the decedents, that is, the passenger decedents. And her complaint alleges negligence and also strict liability. Although she sues as the personal representatives of the estates of these passengers, she is no way related to them. At the time of bringing this action, all of the heirs and survivors of the deceased passengers were Scottish. Gainal Reno was a resident of the state of California and a secretary in the office of the attorney for the plaintiffs. The only connection which the United States has with this accident at all was the fact that some 7 years or so prior to the time that the accident occurred, the aircraft had been manufactured in the United States by Piper Aircraft Company. And at the time of its manufacture, it was equipped with a propeller that was manufactured by Hartzell in Ohio. Almost immediately after its manufacture, the aircraft was sold to an interest in Ohio and by some chain of events not known to the defendants, found its way over to Scotland. On the motion of the defendants, the United States District Court for the Middle District of Pennsylvania granted an order dismissing this action on the ground of forum nonconvenience, and it conditioned that dismissal, as courts generally do, on the defendants waiving any statute of limitations defense they might have and agreeing to submit to the jurisdiction of the courts in Scotland. It might be well to point out here at this particular time that these same plaintiffs have brought actions in Scotland against the operating company, against the owner of the aircraft, two Scottish interests, against the pilot's estate, a Scottish interest, and indeed against the British Civil Aviation Authority. And the pilot's estate himself has also started an action over in Great Britain. In the memorandum opinion which accompanied the order, the district court considered the factors set forth in this court, by this court, in the seminal forum nonconvenience case of Gulf Oil against Gilbert and its progeny. And it concluded that the defendants had shown overwhelming reasons for a forum nonconvenience dismissal. And that court also said that it would be no less than an abuse of discretion on its part if it did not dismiss on the ground of forum nonconvenience, as the Gilbert criteria, quote, overwhelmingly point to dismissal, end quote. The district court weighed all of the private interest factors set forth in Gilbert and found that they all clearly pointed to trial in Scotland. The district court also weighed the public interest factors laid down in Gilbert and similarly concluded that all of these, too, favored a trial in Scotland. And in considering these public interests, the district court said that uppermost in its mind was the fact that a trial could be complex and confusing to a jury because it would have to apply the rule of law of Scotland to Hartzell and the rules of liability law of Pennsylvania to Piper.
Mr. Fitzsimon, let me get a little more background. This suit was instituted in California.
It was instituted in California and sent to Pennsylvania on a 1404 transfer.
By whose motion?
By the motion of the defendant, Defendant Piper. Hartzell, at that time, made a motion to dismiss because it was not subject to the jurisdiction of the court.
Is your client the Pennsylvania Corporation?
They are a Delaware corporation, I believe, Your Honor.
Is Hartzell a Pennsylvania corporation?
They are Heil. But the principal place of business of Piper is in Pennsylvania. That's where this aircraft was manufactured.
So that, in effect, you accomplished one transfer and then sought a second?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that that was required because the court over in California had no jurisdiction to pass upon the situation with respect to Hartzell, where jurisdiction did not lie. And the district court found that this did not constitute any reason why it should not be heard. In any event, the circuit court also found that the product liability law of Scotland would not apply to Hartzell, but indeed that the law of Pennsylvania would apply to both. And what the court said was this. The court held that if the case were transferred over to Scotland, that the Scottish law would apply, and the plaintiffs would lose their cause of action for strict liability, and that this was impermissible. The Third Circuit cited De Mateos against Texaco, Inc. as authority, and it held that a dismissal for forum nonconvenience, like a statutory transfer under 1404A, should not, despite its convenience, result in a change in the applicable law.
Did you also say that in Scotland there would be no trial by jury?
I'm not certain that there would not be a trial by jury in Scotland, Your Honor. I know that there would not be in England, but I'm not certain about that subject in Scotland.
Where is the critical passage where you claim the Court of Appeals said that the change of law is the crux of their decision?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe I can. Oh, they did not say in so many words that it is the crux of their decision, but they started right up front, Your Honor, by discussing the question of law, and what they said beginning, what they said in effect was that was the only public factor that they considered, and then at the end of their opinion they said we don't have to consider any others. And I refer the court to A-139.
As I read the Court of Appeals opinion, it started right out and reviewed all of the factors that the district court had considered in dismissing and differed with the district court on every single factor.
Your Honor, I...
Is that right or not?
Not the way I read the court.
You think if they hadn't thought what they did about the change of the law, that they would have approved the dismissal?
I believe that they should have, Your
Honor.
Well,
I know, but do you think they would have? I thought they disagreed with the district court on every single factor.
Mr. Justice White, the way I read that decision is that they considered three private factors: convenience of witnesses, compulsory processes, interpleader, and view of the premises.
That none of them would warrant the dismissal.
That's right. And then one public. Well, that's in view of the fact that there would be the change of the law, Your Honor. You can't that's inherent in the decision. And on the public side, they just took the applicable law only, just that one. So they did not go through every one that the district court had gone through. In any event, Your Honor, the decision...
I had the same problem Justice White did, Frank. I thought they were saying that the district court was wrong in thinking the jury would be confused by the foreign law and the differences in law and things of that nature.
Well, Your Honor,
relying entirely on this point.
The circuit court clearly held that the law which would be applied to both defendants would be the Pennsylvania law. Court did say in so many words, that you cannot have a dismissal where that would work a change in the law.
Where do they say that?
They say that, Your Honor, and I will show it to you. It's starting on 139 of the appendix. Even under the district court's choice of law analysis requiring a mixture of American and Scottish law, it is apparent that the dismissal would work a change in the applicable law so that the plaintiff's strict liability claim would be eliminated from the case. But this court has held that a dismissal for forum nonconvenience like a statutory transfer should not, despite its convenience, result in a change of the applicable law. Only when the American law is not applicable or when that foreign jurisdiction would, as a matter of its own choice of law, give the plaintiffs the benefit of the claim to which he's entitled here.
But the court held that the district court was wrong on this. It says even under the district court's choice of law analysis. Then it went on to say what you said. But the Court of Appeals said the district court was quite wrong in its choice of law analysis.
That's what the circuit court said.
They went ahead. Nevertheless, went ahead and said what you say. What if they were right that the American law that governs?
Well, Your Honor, even if that were true, the inequities that would be involved that the district court did not treat with or treated with improperly certainly should have called for
dismissal. Well, that may be so, but that's a different point. That's a different point. Where does the Court of Appeals say that if there was a transfer or if there was a dismissal that the Scottish law would apply if the case were tried in Scotland, even though under their analysis the law of Pennsylvania would apply?
Your Honor, I cannot point to that exactly, but I know that was a finding on the part of the district court
the Court of Appeals?
I may be able to find.
Let's assume that the Scottish courts would apply the American law, like the Court of Appeals held should be applicable.
If Scotland would do that,
mm-hmm.
Your Honor, then it would be all right.
Then there should be a transfer. There should be a dismissal, shouldn't there?
If they were going to apply that law, in any event, they should be, Your Honor, because the basic unfairness of this rule, the way it is right now, is briefly as follows. It requires a Scottish plaintiff to come over here to America to prosecute the case. It handicaps the defendant, and the defendant cannot add the parties that it needs to. The parties that the district court found to be necessary parties to be impleaded, such as the owner, the operator, and the estate of the pilot. Should the defendant so handicapped lose, it now, an American defendant, has to go all the way over to Scotland.
Well, that's right, but
to press its action, and that is just basically unfair, Your Honor.
Well, that the Court of Appeals didn't think it was.
Not in light of the fact of their basis that the Pennsylvania law, that there could not be a change in the law, and I say that's the hinge pin of their decision.
Yeah, well, that's, I understand.
Mr.
Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, if I may continue where my brother Fitzsimons half left off in terms of the decision below, I believe it should be pointed out, first, that the opinion of the Court below was very loosely structured, and it is difficult to follow. But if one reads what it said and reads what it has decided, it is comparatively clear. It went first through the so-called private factors discussed by the district court. As to three of them, it found the district court in error in relying upon them for grounds of transfer. It did not say that they were grounds for retaining the case in Pennsylvania. They had a weight of zero. One of them, the inability of the defendants to implead those in Scotland who we believe are responsible for the accident, the court said the district court erred in assigning it great weight. It was entitled to weight, the court said, but not so much. We're left then on the private factors, with all being given a weight of zero and one being given a lesser weight, but still weight, toward dismissal. We turn to the public factors enumerated in the Gilbert case. The court undertook to examine them all. It got, if I may say so, bewitched by the intricacies of the choice of law problem, ended up with the belief that the Pennsylvania law would be applied by the Pennsylvania court.
Mr. Gardner, this may be as appropriate a place as any for me to ask you questions on my mind, and it's language from Gulf Oil Corporation versus Gilbert on page 508, where the court says factors of public interest also have a place in applying the doctrine. Administrative difficulties follow for courts where litigation is piled up in congested centers instead of being handled at its origin. Jury duty is a burden that ought not to be imposed upon the people of a community which has no relation to the litigation. Isn't forum nonconvenience not just a doctrine to be fought out between the plaintiffs and the defendants, but doesn't the federal judicial administration have a stake in it?
It obviously has, sir. The common formulation, the shorthand formulation for the many factors enumerated by Justice Jackson, is the convenience of the parties and the interest of justice. All of those factors, which you have just enumerated, Your Honor, are a part of the complex collection of factors that should be balanced. All were forgotten by the Third Circuit. It reached the conclusion that there would be an adverse change in law if the case were filed in Scotland, and categorically said at pages 139 and 140 that that was sufficient to prevent grant of the motion. Adverse to the plaintiff. At page 156 of the joint appendix, in its concluding paragraph, It said, as the policy interests of Pennsylvania and Ohio, upon which it relied to determine that Pennsylvania law would be applied, point to trial here, is unnecessary. All other factors will point similarly. In short, he considered none but the choice of law problem. The only place in the whole 38 pages below where the decision is explained is the one paragraph at 139 and 140. After the review of private factors, just drifted off. No conclusion was drawn. As I've said, the only conclusion that could be drawn from the private factors was a weak, in the view of the court below, factor pointing toward dismissal.
Was that entirely clear? Are there precedents?
Nothing in this opinion is entirely clear, sir.
I'm just wondering, in this body of law, are there cases in which a manufacturer has been sued for a product defect in his home office where the product was manufactured, where he's ever gotten dismissal on forum nonconvenience
grounds? Yes, sir.
There are not very many, are there?
There haven't been all that many product liability cases.
I could imagine this motion being made by the defendants if suit had been brought in Scotland on the ground that there are witnesses and relevant records and so forth at the Home Office.
The difference between a suit in Scotland and a suit in Pennsylvania is that in Scotland, both parties can try their case. The defendant will, and has no objection having the dismissal so conditioned, transport to Scotland all of its witnesses, all of its records, if they wish to try out product liability on an aircraft 7 years old.
Well, the AT case is partly because it was originally filed in California and transferred.
Hartzell was not sued in California. We were not served properly. The defendants cannot try out the negligence of the air taxi, the pilot, or the owner and maintenance in the United Kingdom and in Scotland.
Is that all a defense if the product was defective?
We can assume, sir, I believe, that if the product were defective, it surely was joined, or such is our position, by negligence on the part of those who were maintaining and operating the aircraft. We cannot assume and say, therefore, the defendants cannot try their case, that there was no negligence. And we cannot try our case without compulsory process. None of the Scotch witnesses would willingly testify.
Mr. Gardner, I take it that one of the questions here is not whether the Court of Appeals was right in its choice of law conclusions.
It inheres in the question.
Well, certainly you didn't expressly raise the question.
It's discussed in our brief. In the event the Court wished to examine the premise.
If we wish to, well, I don't know that we particularly wish to.
In that case, it's not here.
Let me ask, well, if it isn't here, and we judge this case on the basis that the Court of Appeals was correct in saying that if the case were tried in America, that the state law, the American law would apply, if we judge it on that basis, what evidence I'll put it this way, are you in agreement or are all the parties in agreement that if the case were shifted to Scotland, that the American law would not apply?
That is my belief, sir.
Well, that's your belief, but did the Court of Appeals say so?
The Court of Appeals so stated. You're asking me to...
No, I can ask the other side.
Yes, I
certainly shall.
I qualified my answer.
But your view is that
that the courts there would apply Scottish law rather than American law.
We agree. That's one of the few points in those 38 pages that we agree with.
Where do they say that?
At page 137,
right.
139, and 147. The discussion is not connected. These are isolated sentences. But you will find between those three references the statement that the Scottish courts would apply lex loci delicto to choose the law, and that under Scottish law, there would be no strict liability, but rather negligence.
Well, I think everybody agrees with that, but the question is whether they would apply the Scottish law.
Well, if it were tried in Scotland. I go back then to an earlier statement that the court said, I believe correctly, that the Scottish courts apply the doctrine of lex loci delicto, would apply the law of the place of the accident, and if they're, like any other court, if they were tempted to apply another law, they'd look at the place of residence of the plaintiffs and find that, too, to be Scotland. I think there's no possible doubt.
Not like any other court, because the Court of Appeals of the Third Circuit didn't do that.
I amend my statement, sir, to say not
all
like
except
most reasonable
the Court of Appeals
courts,
of the Third Circuit.
But like most courts. Right. It's perhaps the kindest way to phrase it.
I don't find the statement of the Court of Appeals that you referred to very categorical, Mr. Gardner.
It's not categorical, sir, but if you've read those three sentences.
Well, I have to read three pages first before I find the sentence.
Wonder if I may help.
You may.
What particular sentence, if you'll take one for page 137 and help us focus on that?
We start with the beginning of the paragraph at the bottom, which states that under the applicable choice of law rules, American or Scottish law would apply.
Well,
and
they're reciting the arguments rather than stating their view, at least it's so it seems to me, although somewhat ambiguous.
If you look to page 139, I must have thrown in 137 as the introductory part of it. Page 139, the beginning of the last paragraph, is reasonably categorical. Relating the affidavit of Scottish counsel. To the effect that the Scottish...
You take it as a conclusion of the court, beginning and therefore... Scotland probably would apply its own law to all claims. You suggest we read that as a holding, as their holding.
I think so. Yeah. If you come to page 147, which is my third reference, you'll find that the court assumes that there would be a conflict between American strict liability and Scottish negligence law, if it had not been for its application of the so-called governmental interests. I have not been able to remove my feet from the quagmire of the decision below, and I would like to save a few minutes for rebuttal. If the court permits, I will save my remaining time for the rebuttal.
I'd
refer the court, please, to our briefs for our position on the law.
Mr. Cathcart.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
I think that you don't have the same difficulties that your friends have with understanding this opinion.
No, sir. I find it to be a very, very fine and well-written and well-reasoned opinion.
Fine, but let's address the clarity of it and tell us where they hold what you say they hold.
I say they hold that when applying the
factors of Gulf Oil versus Gilbert, which have been applied for since 1947 in cases of this nature, they have no trouble finding an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court judge. And this carefully written opinion examines each one of those factors and makes it very clear that the case turns on an abuse of discretion. It does not turn on the question of foreign law. If we look at page 4 of the decision, I'm sorry I don't have it referenced as to the index which accompanied our briefs, but the court language on page 4 makes it very clear.
Where will we find it? Is that in your?
It's in the appellate decision, and I can quickly find it because it's very early in
the
text.
In the petition.
In the joint appendix, yes. And where will we find the carefully written opinion of the Third Circuit?
That's a matter of qualitative judgment, which I find it to be a very thorough analysis.
Well, you claim it begins at page...
it's the fourth page.
118 of the appendix, that's where the opinion begins?
It's just a little bit farther into the opinion, if I can find the exact language wherein the court indicated that the trial judge abused his discretion in dismissing the action. And the court went on to say, in quotes, subsidiary, but arguably crucial, to this second point is the claim.
I wish I knew where you were reading.
All right, let me see if I can quickly find that for you in the appendix.
I see it, page A120, I guess, in the appendix, consolidated joint appendix, page A120, the last paragraph before you get to Roman numeral 1. The trial judge abused his discretion in dismissing the action.
Well, that's just reciting what the claim is. That's just a contention.
That is correct. There is, I believe, on the fourth page, the... And if I could just count it, because they're approximately
the same length. I've got another
copy of the decision, which perhaps will
make it faster.
Maybe the subsidiary sentence is not part of the contention. It's hard to tell.
It is on page 100, A120 of the decision, in the second complete paragraph.
Starting in this court, Reno raises two major contentions?
Yes, sir. That is where I find it. And those are the two.
It describes the contention, it doesn't describe the holding.
Yes, sir, that is correct. But the holding of the court, as we go through the decision, was based upon a careful examination of every one of the Gulf Oil versus Gilbert factors and a weighing of these and concluding that we have in this case an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court judge. And based upon that, the case turned. Now, the court went on to indicate that where American law applies, a forum non-convenience dismissal should not be granted. And in that instance, in looking through the cases cited by the petitioners here.
Well, on page 131, it says the standard of review is one of abuse of discretion. But if the trial court has not held the defendants to their proper burden or has clearly erred in weighing the factors, the equivalent of an abuse of discretion has been demonstrated. Discretion must be exercised within the applicable standards. And then the court goes on to the applicable factors and disagrees with the district court.
That is correct in every instance.
What law do you say applies to the claims of the negligence of the pilot?
The law as to the negligence of the pilot may very well be governed by Scottish law, but the negligence of the pilot in a products liability action is not a defense, and therefore we may not need to have the trier of the fact judge by any standard his negligence. The plaintiff in this case has a burden of proof under the law the domestic American law of products liability, of establishing fault, either under restatement of tort second 402 second, or under a variation thereof.
How old was this?
And proximate cause.
How old was this aircraft?
The aircraft was several years old. I can't tell the court exactly how old it is, but I believe five or six years old.
6 years old.
But the distinction I'd like to draw for you, Mr. Chief Justice, is that this is a design defect case. The plaintiffs are alleging that the design of the aircraft was a proximate cause of the accident and that that design was defective. So we're going beyond attacking one item, that is, that there was a defect in manufacture.
Is there anything that shows how many error hours were logged in this aircraft?
There is nothing in the record as of this moment, because we have been dealing with procedural matters and not with discovery matters.
Well, I raise that because whether this is, would turn out to be a product liability case or a negligence case in terms of the pilot error is not very clear now, is it?
It is clear what our burden must be in order to prevail against the manufacturer, since we represent the estates of passengers on board the airplane.
What's the connection of the of Reynaud with the passengers on board the airplane?
Gaynell Reynaud is the nominal party plaintiff, was appointed by the Los Angeles County Superior Court as personal representative of the estate. She at the time was a secretary within my law firm, and she is not a real party in interest. She was appointed because under California procedural law, an action for wrongful death can be brought in the names of the heirs. It also can be brought on behalf of the heirs by the personal representative of an estate. Since we do have choice of law issues here as to what wrongful death statute does apply, or we at least had them at the time that this case began, we had to choose or elect in which form to bring the action.
But don't you run up there against the when you get into the federal court, that there are public factors involved, too, where perhaps the federal courts could be better utilized for matters of more directly federal concern than a secretary in a law office acting as executor for a parties in a private damage action.
She certainly is only a nominal plaintiff, and therefore her interest is only that of occupying a title and discharging a court-appointed responsibility. But the real parties in interest are people who have lost their breadwinners. And it's a matter of which should be of great concern to a federal court. And
they're
this
all
case
in Scotland,
is,
aren't they?
They are all in Scotland.
And they could sue in Scotland.
They could sue in Scotland. There may or may not get jurisdiction, but the defendants, as they typically do in cases of this nature, have agreed to waive statutes of limitations and to make themselves subject to the jurisdiction of a foreign court because of the obvious advantages which inure to them under different law, different standards, and lack of a trial by jury. And there's no question, one of the attractive features besides the location of a substantial quantum of proof as to a design defect being right at the manufacturer's place of business is the fact that I still believe, and I think my clients believe, our system of justice is without equal in our system of determining what is just and adequate compensation for real losses.
So you wanted to establish a principle that anybody injured in any nation on the face of this earth, injured by a product made in the United States, can sue in the United States.
I'm not asking this question.
Our justice isn't that broad now, is it?
I don't think it should be that broad, and that's what I'm not seeking here.
Well, aren't you
trying?
You can carry it at least to the United Kingdom.
No, sir, I'm not trying to do that, Justice Marshall. I'm trying, under the facts of this case, to demonstrate the right of people who indeed are aliens to sue a U.S. manufacturer, in this case two U.S. manufacturers, for claimed defects in their products, which, by happenstance, because of an airplane being what it is, an object which can be anticipated to go to many jurisdictions.
A toy cart in Russia, if it was made in the United States.
It might, if we went through all the Gulf Oil versus Gilbert factors and concluded that this was an appropriate place to sue and that the defendant, under the fact situation, did not meet its burden. I'm certainly not trying to ask this court, as I believe the petitioners are, to come up with new law, a new doctrine, that aliens should not be allowed to bring actions for products liability in this country. And I think that's the way, even though the issue was quite limited under which certiorari was granted, the briefs have been expanded to encourage this court to make such a finding. I don't believe we should close the doors.
Well, wouldn't the Third Circuit, in Justice Marshall's example, wouldn't the Third Circuit come to the same conclusion that it did with respect to the applicable law? It may not have with respect to the transfer factors, but as respect to the applicable law, it would hold the American law applies.
The third,
Justice Marshall's example.
The
toy in Russia, made in the United States.
The United States, the Third Circuit might very well find.
Might, would, wouldn't it?
Well, if we read DiMatteo's and the Renault decision, I think the probabilities are that they would. But
yes.
If we look at DiMatteo's, we see a case in which had no American connection whatsoever that was of significance.
But here we have a case in which it is not yet clear whether it's pilot error, negligence of the pilot, or whether it's a product liability case. I take it you'd concede that.
I concede the defendants have a contention, and to that extent that they've urged it, it is not clear.
In the case, there's no such complication.
There perhaps is not such a complication, Mr. Chief Justice. One of the things that I think is important is that the question of, from the cases that I have examined and been able to find, is the question of foreign law has never been the determining factor. It certainly wasn't in DiMatteo's. DiMatteo's, they found, had no connection to the United States other than by happenstance. It happened to just barely cross the line into our territorial waters. But if we go through the various decisions, ones in the Dover Straits, most of them are from Admiralty, we don't have a clear-cut case where American law has been the determining factor.
Well, under the common law forum non conveniens rule, the change of law didn't prevent a dismissal, did it?
I don't think it did, and I don't know that it should. I think it's a factor. It's a Gulf Oil versus Gilbert factor the court should consider.
The Court of Appeals here thought it was a rather substantial factor.
They did indeed.
And
they
so do you.
I do believe it's a significant factor from a...
But under the... You say you haven't seen any old cases like that. Well, I thought that the do you find any old common law cases on forum non conveniens that makes the change of law a substantial factor?
I don't know of a case that makes it a determining factor.
No, and you do have cases where there would be a change of law if it was tried in another forum and the case was nevertheless dismissed.
I do not know of any recent cases. And
I didn't
none,
ask you. I didn't ask that.
All right. I know
there are hardly any, I suppose, under the federal rules.
I don't
believe
so. Just
be international cases.
I would perhaps that is correct, and I know of none, and I can cite none to the court.
Let me come back to an earlier point that was discussed somewhat. What's to prevent the Scottish court, if the case goes there, from applying American law?
The only information that we have on Scottish law is in the affidavits of counsel that are included in the joint appendix. And they strongly suggest that the Scottish courts would apply the law of Scotland.
Well, they suggest that, but on the other hand, isn't the possibility of the Scottish court applying American law precisely what Justice Brandeis said in Canada Malti?
Yes. And but we cannot, from this record, determine.
You don't want to take that risk.
Well, I don't want to take that risk at this stage of the proceedings when it was not raised that strongly in the lower court. We have another factor in this case because, as I understand the limited issue, we're talking about whether it can be denied merely because foreign law were applied. And I submit, and it is the position of the respondents, that it is merely an element that must be considered and should be considered. But we go to another factor, which I think is a very important factor in this case, and that is the defendant in this case has moved this case already and moved this case upon the representation to the courts involved by way of affidavits that Pennsylvania is overwhelmingly fair to all parties. In addition, by way of affidavit, Piper has said, the affidavit of November 22, 1977, judicial, temporal, and geographical interest is best served by transfer to Pennsylvania. The propriety of transferring the within action to Pennsylvania for the convenience of witness overwhelms other factors. Now, that defendant should be stopped from now coming into court and saying, now that we have moved you to our own backyard, you should...
Comparing California with Pennsylvania, weren't they?
They were comparing the reasons.
There was no issue at that time as to whether the case should be tried in Scotland.
That is correct. They did not raise it at this time, but they pointed out, using Gulf Oil versus Gilbert criteria, why it should be transferred to Pennsylvania and transferred to the place of manufacture.
Is there anything that would prevent you from refiling your case in the Pennsylvania State Court?
I perhaps could refile it, but I suspect I'd be removed on diversity.
You'd have to know what's the Pennsylvania law on dead people filing lawsuits.
I know I'm reasonably familiar with the wrongful death statute of Pennsylvania.
You are?
Reasonably, sir.
Well, I was trying to save you from answering the question.
I, under the pressure of the moment, did not appreciate that or able to take advantage of that.
What's the answer?
The answer to the question is, basically, I'm not clear what the question is.
Well, the question was whether they could file in Pennsylvania. I think you started to say if you did,
yes,
they'd transfer it to the federal court, which would then dismiss it.
The federal court, unless guided by the Third Circuit opinion, which hopefully will remain the law of this case, would have to leave the case, I assume, intact here on the basis that certainly it's an important element here under Gulf Oil that the very wrong of which the plaintiffs complained, the defective design of the airplane, took place in Pennsylvania, right at the place where this trial is going to be held, and presumably the manufacturer and all of his employees and people who were instrumental are located there, as is a substantial amount of proof concerning the manufacturing process, the role of the Federal Aviation Administration in that process, and so on.
Are you so sure that a state action in Pennsylvania would automatically be removable? One of your defendants has principal place of business in Pennsylvania, I was told.
Yes, Piper does have a principal place of business in they have a principal place of business in Pennsylvania and also in the state of Florida. And although I believe them to be nominally a Delaware corporation.
Well, is there diversity? Oh, you're California plaintiff, right?
Yes,
yeah, right.
Yes, sir. Or Scottish people.
There may still be no diversity.
There still may be no diversity.
In view of the principal place of business. One last question. Do I understand an action is pending in the courts of Scotland?
Yes, there is an action pending, not against the manufacturers, but there is an action pending in the courts of Scotland, which was filed after the procedural issues arose as to whether these people would be allowed to go forward or would not be allowed to go forward in the United States of America.
You said not against the manufacturer. Against whom, then?
It would be against the operator of the aircraft, the owner, and perhaps against the deceased pilot's estate. On that, I do not know for sure. What we have here, or what is solicited by the defendants in this case as manufacturers and urged by major airframe manufacturers in their amicus curiae briefs, is an effort to cause this court to adopt a policy to close the door in products liability cases on accidents which involve products defectively made in the United States but which are sold abroad and which the manufacturer can be expected to be involved in accidents in any place of the globe because of the ubiquitous nature of aircraft and large aircraft in particular. And this the law of the United States has not gone that far. As a matter of fact, the law of the United States so far has where there is a U.S. connection and a reason particularly to apply American law, the courts of the United States have been open to the victims of aviation accidents around the world. And in a design case, it's particularly important that they be open because design involves not just one defective article, but involves perhaps a fleet of articles, articles operating in this country and elsewhere in which the United States has a significant interest. We have then the manufacturers trying to use a procedural rule to bring about a substantive result, a procedural rule which would, under given circumstances, deny causes of action and deny, in some circumstances, the right of recovery against U.S. manufacturers for defectively made products here. That, in my opinion, is a policy which should not be encouraged and should not be sanctioned by the highest court of this land. The dismissal process should not be used as a protective shield to determine the outcome of litigation, but to the contrary, it should be used only when there is no real nexus to the United States of America and no conceivable basis upon which the manufacturer could play a role in the U.S.-based manufacturer could play a role in the manufacturing process. I think our position is that based on the limited issue to which certiorari has been granted, that no matter how this court decides that issue, it should not be determinative or result in a reversal of the Third Circuit Court opinion because of the very detailed and elaborate weighing of all of the Gulf Oil versus Gilbert factors. And as urged in our brief, because the decision clearly, from the depth of that decision and the detail in the decision and examining those factors, the decision turns not on foreign law or whether it does or does not apply, although it was a significant factor by the court. It is clear that all of the other Gulf Oil versus Gilbert factors also were found by the appellate court to cause this court, the appellate court, to believe that there was an abuse of discretion by the trial judge and a failure to meet the burden of proof which the forum nonconvenience cases impose upon a moving party, and there was no evidence presented which shows that suing a manufacturer in his own backyard where the alleged wrongful conduct was conducted is somehow vexing or harassing a defendant.
Ask, do you interpret our limited grant as indicating that this court has already read the Court of Appeals opinion to have turned exclusively on the possibility that the law might change if the case were dismissed?
I don't read it on that alone. I read
well,
it.
Well, we limited the grant to just a single question, didn't we?
Yes, it was limited to a single question where many others were raised. And that's why, although the petitioners have sought a review of this court, ab initio, of whether the Third Circuit acted properly or did not act properly on all issues, the granting of the writ, which is limited to the issue of must a motion to dismiss on grounds of forum nonconvenience be denied whenever the law of the alternate forum is less favorable to recovery than that which would be applied by the district court. Well, if we answer that question yes or no, because of the word whenever, or as used by counsel in argument and in their briefs, merely by showing, we are not expanding this to be a broad issue.
Well, part of your argument, I take it, is that even if the law weren't going to change, that the Court of Appeals nevertheless found no basis for the transfer.
That is correct. Even if foreign law were to be applied, and because we're applying in 1404A transfers foreign law frequently, when we take the conflicts of laws principles involved, and it may require the use of foreign law, i.e. the law of a foreign state, in deciding a case. And the according to Van Dusen versus Berwick, the law of the transferor state accompanies the transfer of the file, including its conflict of laws. And accordingly, a transferee court can apply a foreign law, albeit a foreign state, but there's no distinction of any great significance to whether or not it's foreign state or foreign country.
The Third Circuit seems to have said unequivocally that if there is a difference, dismissal would not be justified.
It says that at page 140. It certainly did, and it adopted its own language out of DiMatteos. But if
and that's apparently the rule that they apply in the Third Circuit. If we do not agree with that rule, don't we have a duty to vacate the judgment and say, take a look at the case without the benefit of that rule?
I don't believe so, because I don't think the decision in the lower court turned on that one statement. It turned on a myriad of factors, and that one statement, although important and of significance, was not determinative. It was not determinative in DiMatteos, because in DiMatteos, the court found that there was no nexus to American law whatsoever, and therefore the court did not have to answer that question. It said this case does not belong in the United States under the factual context. It is all
foreign. Do you think that statement is a correct statement of the law?
I think that it is a correct statement to say.
You defend that rationale.
I defend that rationale.
You really haven't. You pretty much argued, well, they really didn't mean what they said.
I don't believe that it needs to extend that far to justify the opinion of the Third Circuit. The opinion can stand even if this Court should disagree with that statement. I do not find that statement in any opinions other than those by the Third Circuit and by some of the text writers in the subject who have suggested strongly that as in the Fifth Circuit, in the Fisher versus Agios Nicholas V, 628 F. 2nd 308, which is cited in our brief, that says where U.S. law is applicable, jurisdiction is retained. And I think that's one side of the coin. But what do we do if U.S. law is not applicable? And that is something that is not before us at this time. Thank you, sir.
Now we'll take up your rebuttal at 1 o'clock.